Hello, what's your point?
You know, I would be remiss if I didn't mention, Garnett, the important role that you're playing on WPKN in not simply independent journalism and making sure voices get out. The reality is that as we talk about social media and criticism and hashtags, conversation, like deep dialogue about these issues, is really what we're going to need if we're going to ever get to that point of reimagination. So I just wanted to thank you. You know, we've got to live for the revolution, and that revolution really is going to have to be one that allows us to conquer these inequalities and move forward as a nation as a whole, but also as a community united.
Okay, thank you so much. I believe dialogue is very important for the continuation and maintenance of a democracy. One should be tolerant of all views different to yours. It is much better to use words to settle differences than with weapons. You see, weapons destroy human beings. When all these differing views are put together, a consensus should be found to move the nation forward together for one common cause. At the end of an argument, we may disagree but not become disagreeable. Welcome to another edition of What's Your Point here on WPKN Radio. The show is aired fortnightly at 9 a.m. Eastern Time. I am Garnett Anker. And my thought for today, a few lines from the poem The Second Coming by the Irish poet William Butler Yeats. Things fall apart. The center cannot hold. Mere anarchy is loosed upon the world. The blood-dimmed tide is loosed, and everywhere the ceremony of innocence is drowned. The best lack all conviction, while the worst are full of passionate intensity. A few lines from William Butler Yeats's Second Coming. A lot is going on in the United States and the wider world today. It is very important to stay up to date with the goings on, and especially here in the United States. On the show today, I will discuss with my guest some of the challenges of today, from the botched federal response to the COVID-19 pandemic, the purpose of the ongoing population census, and the role of a free press in the United States. My guest is the founding dean of the Honors College and a professor in the History Department, University of South Alabama, Mobile, Alabama. Before going south 3 years ago, my guest was a professor of history in the History Department at Quinnipiac University here in Connecticut. Full disclosure, my guest taught me history while I was a student at Quinnipiac University. A big welcome to Kathy Cook. Hi, Kathy. How are you doing?
Hi, Garnett. Thank you so much. I'm doing well, all things considered in the world today. Aside from that, which is hard to put aside, I'm well, thank you. It's delightful to be speaking with you today.
Okay. Thank you so much for doing it. And how are you coping with the COVID-19 pandemic?
Yeah, so coping with COVID, I think I've been in a relatively fortunate position. I work at the University of South Alabama, as you mentioned, and was living in Mobile, but my spouse and son still live in New Haven, Connecticut. And when the university closed down and went online last March, I had already found myself in, I was in New York City with a group of students from South Alabama. So I sent them home safely with my colleagues and stayed in Connecticut, where I have spent most of the spring and summer working intensely and remotely. So I, like many people, have coped through Zoom and been fortunate enough still to keep working. And also very fortunate to spend time with my family. And we have a garden that is a lovely distraction from what's happening in the world.
Indeed. So how do you say it has affected your work at the University of South Alabama?
Yeah, it has been a complicated time for everyone. You know, professionally, the thing that stood out was how do we continue our educational processes and our community building while allowing people to keep their distance from each other to stay physically safe. And so we had to do things that were innovative. We have a usual graduation ceremony that we call the Senior Showcase, and we created a virtual opportunity for students to celebrate their work. We used Zoom, but we also created a piece of paper, a tangible item, a virtual tour of our building, which is known as the Siemens Vessel. And students spent a lot of time there, and they were abruptly cut off from that space. So we created some virtual reality goggles using Google Cardboard and a tour of the space so that they could visit it before they graduated. So we tried to be very innovative, but also very caring for students whose lives were upended, for students who became ill. One of my students in New York did come down with COVID, and many students were out of work or were trying to do online courses from home. So it's been a balance of carrying on and making sure that we're able to do for students what they expect from us, but also care for them in a very human and difficult set of circumstances. So it has been this ongoing balance of care, support, but also providing, you know, what was promised them through their educational process.
So that student who came down with the virus, how's he or she doing at this time, if you know?
He's doing fine. We were in touch immediately. We wanted to make sure, of course, that no one else in the group became ill, and also make sure he was safe. And it was a 3-week process for him. And I think that he would say, and I've subsequently had other students who've become ill, all of whom have recovered. But I think it started out sort of slow and deceptively mild, but there were definitely moments of alarm and fear and extraordinary fatigue, I think, was the primary thing. So he's well, but it definitely was an experience that he would prefer to avoid.
It's really good to know that. And we'll come back to the COVID situation in a while. But before that, how is the Honors College, and how did you get to be there in terms of setting up this new college?
Right. I'm not sure I totally... I'll tell you more about the Honors College, and if that's not your question, please clarify. So the Honors College is founded on, it has three pillars. We bring in students who are in particular interested in really what you might call a traditional liberal arts experience. And to do that, we ask them to think about their intellectual curiosity and to engage fully in the educational experience. So that's pillar number one. Pillar number two is we look for them to accentuate their natural leadership ability or to find a way to lead if they're more introverted, and that's through engagement as thoroughly as possible with their educational experience. So intellectual curiosity, engagement. And then the third is the creation of knowledge and culture. We ask students to participate in that larger educational enterprise. Often we think about education as that passive process for students, a passive experience of learning. and the instructor being the person who provides knowledge, fills up the vessel of all this information and knowledge. And what I emphasize in our community is that there's an often unspoken goal of higher ed, which is not as visible, which is to create knowledge and culture. Faculty are doing research. They are publishing. They're creating artwork and music compositions. And our students participate in that process. They are able also to create knowledge and culture through the writing of a thesis. We have these three pillars, and we found them all on a really strong sense of community. We want students to get to know each other, to figure out how to work with each other, to support each other, and we do that with faculty and staff as well. So that meant that COVID disrupted that sense of in-person community that was so important to what we do.
So the Honors College, is it a part of the Department of History, or is it a separate entity?
Very good. It is a separate entity. It encompasses any major or discipline around the campus. So it's its own standalone college. And the fact that I'm professor of history is that that thing that you take with you even when you're an administrator at a university. My PhD is in history, and my start at Quinnipiac University was in history, and I continued. In fact, just this morning I was writing a project that I'm working on, my own creation of knowledge and culture. So I have my own sort of professional or intellectual or disciplinary home in the Department of History. But the Honors College welcomes students from any major. So it's a university standalone college.
And you're the founding dean of the Honors College, and you also teach the Department of History as well.
That's right. That's exactly right. Yeah. So I'm founding dean, which means that when I came, the university was just transforming from having an honors program, which is what I was director of at Quinnipiac University. And my job was to turn it into a college and help everybody understand what the difference between a college and a program is.
That sounds like a huge job.
For me, I think it was just the right size job, but it's not a small job for sure. But it's also delightful because you get the opportunity to create this opportunity for more students on campus. So that was part of it. We made it bigger. But also to make sure or help, I should say, the larger institution understand why honors is beneficial. And really what that means is why having this locus, this core of students who are so intellectually curious and doing all these things, how that promotes the larger institutional mission for education. So, yeah, that does mean that there's a lot of work, in particular a lot of email, but also I've written grants and overseen a lot of student research projects, and I had a lot of conversations with fellow deans and the president and the provost. It's a very supportive environment, so, and I get to work with really wonderfully inquisitive students. So it's a big job, but it has big rewards.
Why the shift from the Northeast to the Southeast, a place like Alabama?
Right, that's a great question. I mean, you know, the simple, straightforward answer is I got offered a job there. But, that's not necessarily an easy move to make, in particular because my spouse and son stayed in Connecticut. And I had to think long and hard about why, if I wanted to move in that direction. I actually had another job offer as well that would have allowed me to stay in a more familiar region of the country. But part of the driver for me was understanding regional diversity in this country. So there is a tendency in the Northeast, maybe. I never want to speak for anyone else, though. I'm just speaking from my own experience, where it was a little bit easy for people to be disparaging about the South in any number of ways. And I wanted to relocate. So here's sort of a background phrase. I call myself a radical non-assumer, or that's something I aspire to. And so if I were to hear somebody make an off-the-cuff remark about what the South is like, I would feel, and sometimes I would say a little, I would feel uncertain about that characterization, because if you haven't lived there, you really don't know. And I had heard enough disparaging comments that when I had the opportunity to move to the South, I realized I had an opportunity to get to know a region of the country that might be terribly misunderstood. And then the other thing was I did take the job soon after the election of the current president, and I live in a very blue state, and I thought it might be helpful for me to understand the support that Donald Trump was getting by moving to a red state. So it was actually a sort of self-education, an opportunity for myself to engage.
So what did he come up with in terms of why was he being supported?
Well, I think that he is appealing to a certain disposition that occurs all around the country. So it's not just in the South. We know that there's a lot of support for this president in the South, but also in the center of the country, really throughout. He has a very strong base of about 35-38%. And I think that there is a set of structures. He values authority. And there are many people that value authority. There's a kind of clarity in his thinking. There are problems as well. When I think about this, I think about the writing by a social psychologist who's at this discipline named Jonathan Haidt, and he has a book called The Righteous Mind, and it's a book that helps to understand political divisions in the United States. And he talks about the flavors of morality. And there is a flavor of morality that's oriented towards authority and following the rules. And then there's another, and that tends to be associated with more right-wing or red state dispositions. And then there's one that's oriented more towards opportunity and fairness. And so by going to Alabama, I wanted to see if that held up in practice. Actually, what I really wanted, though, was to see, you know, I figure if you live with people, then you're going to understand them better. And so I can't say that I understood the election better, but I did see that there are people like me, right? And I'm a person like them. So it really became an opportunity to just engage in the day-to-day human conversations that we all experience.
When is it
like sitting at a restaurant?
When is it people like you? What do you mean?
Human beings are human beings to some degree. So if I were to speak to somebody in a restaurant, we would talk about the quality of food, right? We might, in one case, and that's the other thing I noticed, a very outgoing culture. I was sitting alone in a restaurant at the counter. Another woman, in this case, was sitting at the restaurant, and she commented on my food and said, oh, I thought about ordering that, but I thought it was, you know, maybe I wouldn't enjoy it. And I said, oh, would you like a taste? And it's the sort of thing I think I would have done in Connecticut, but people would have said no, and she said yes, you know? So there's this day-to-day experience. We all, not all, but most of us, go to the grocery store, or we did, it was pre-COVID. We go to gas stations. We have this day-to-day life experience that to some degree shared. So that's what I mean, the shared human experience.
You're listening to What's Your Point on WPKN Radio. My guest is Kathy Cook, founding dean at the Honors College and professor in the History Department at the University of South Alabama, Mobile, Alabama. I am Garnet Ankle. We are discussing various current national challenges of the day. Now, Kathy, what are your thoughts on the federal government's initial and ongoing responses to the pandemic?
Well, I find some a little bit disappointing, maybe a lot disappointing. I think the federal government had an opportunity early on. We did have the the shutdown, and I think it took place for very good reasons. One could see around the world the devastation that was being wrought in Italy, just soon after in Spain. We had a lot of evidence about the devastation that the virus could cause. And the country took a really good step by shutting down lots of activity and helping people to understand the importance, or the ways at least in which that could save lives. Then, the messages were mixed, especially with the reopening. And I think what I would have hoped for would have been a little bit more of a coherent, well-planned response that helps people understand why it makes sense to limit your activities, and then how long you might have to do that, and then what activities make sense. And it's been a little bit too much of an on-off switch without a sort of uniform plan and understanding. So I was hopeful, but I have become disappointed.
But it's difficult, though, when you have a person who should be called the president encouraging people to use bleach and Lysol into their bodies, and we have one of the persons who should know better sitting there and said nothing.
Yeah, no, that was a particularly stunning moment in our country, and I think what we're missing is clear scientific guidance. There's a sort of off the cuff approach. What about this? And I would expect that our leadership would be more clear cut when it comes to the actual understood and scientifically founded responses, and that obviously, you know, the suggestion about uses of bleach, it was not helpful as an understatement. It was very, very problematic and disappointing.
And to date, 176,000 people have lost their lives due to the pandemic here alone in the United States, making it the country with the most number of deaths at this point. At one point, it was Italy. And the United States has 5.5 million cases to date. And we have a situation where the federal government is still has not come up with a strategy to combat this disease. And they're just saying, especially the guy in the White House is saying it will soon go away. It's mind-boggling, to say the least. And the people who are supposed to be talking about this, the scientists, are being pushed aside. So how do we confront something like this when we have been left on our own?
Yeah, I mean, and that's a problem nationally. I think in many ways, I'm sort of, there's a sense in this country of the balance between what states do and what the federal government does. And I think in this case, the federal government has tried to share out the responsibility to the states, but, you know, it has been saying, but you should all do this. But science would tell us to do this. Would you listen to the CDC or other guidance? And human beings do better when they have a story that's coherent and that makes sense. And there's not a coherent narrative here that helps guide individuals and their behavior. People are always going to disagree. There's going to be difficulties, but you can guide the vast majority of people. And it's just very disappointing because there's not a clear message, and despite recent claims, it's not been science based. So I share the frustration that you're expressing.
And another thing too is that when we have a president who doesn't speak the truth, it's very difficult to trust him or to trust anything coming out of the administration, and that is another serious problem.
Yeah, and it's rooted in something that's very, very deep in American history, which is there's a strong anti-intellectual tendency. I'm not sure that's the same as not telling the truth, but there's a susceptibility to distrusting expert because the United States has a strong tendency of individualism, which doesn't necessarily say don't trust experts or don't be an intellectual, but there is a very strong drive, trust oneself and one's gut instincts rather than what something else tells you. And this, again, is rooted in the science, as I understand it. I'm not a psychologist or a sociologist, that human beings are very susceptible to believing what aligns with what they already believe. So if you tell somebody something that they already believe, they're going to be much more likely to believe it. And if you try to challenge their beliefs, they just kind of find something wrong with it and dismiss it. So when the president does something that's false, if it aligns with something that somebody's already inclined to believe, it's going to work. It's going to resonate. And so I consider that to put in the nicest terms, it's a mismanagement of human beings who need leadership that moves them forward down that path to full human experience, to, you know, what democracy in the United States promises. And that's being disrupted by false narratives that work in the short term because people are like, oh, I like that. I'm glad that that's what that person is saying. But at the same time, that disrupts real possibility. And so it works in terms of appealing to an audience, but that audience is going to suffer based on those lies. And yes, false representations of the situation, it's just not helpful. And it violates a core principle of leadership, which is people have to trust you.
And we dismiss the information from the scientists at our own peril, because it's not about whether I like cream cheese or not. These are scientific data that these people know and they're telling us. And if we dismiss it, many more people are going to die.
Well, for sure. And that's the other thing that's happening, is people are dismissing at their peril, just as you said. We've also come to accept a high death rate. That if we look at other countries, we have other models that show us that there are ways to have managed this, could still be embraced, that would have led to less death, and also would have led to better economic outcomes. And so, but yes, instead we have, we're getting, well, what is it, 170,000, 180,000 today. And that number is going to continue to go up, but it's acceptable because of a sort of it is what it is approach. And I really dislike, obviously, the use of a statement that's common in our day-to-day talking with each other. Well, it is what it is. But to say it is what it is about a daily death rate that is unnecessary and makes people feel helpless when there are actually things that can be done, and is an attempt to absolve leaders of their responsibility, it's just very disappointing.
You know, for you and I think we have the luxury of saying it is what it is. But that should not be coming from the president or anyone in his surroundings, because they're the ones who should be protecting the nation and do everything to protect us. And we see that we can't rely on them to protect us because they don't speak the truth. And that's one of the biggest thing in everything, because if we can't trust what they're saying, the situation stops right there. For argument's sake, yesterday it was reported that, and this is just simple nonsense, the president said the Democrats at their convention took the word God out of the Pledge of Allegiance, and they replayed it every day on the air. I was listening, and it showed that it was still in it. So why does he go along and tell lies that are irrefutable, that people can go back and check to see that that's not true? and he continues to do that on an almost daily basis. Where do we go from here with that kind of thing? Because we need someone or people in authority who are going to tell us the truth.
Yeah, I hadn't heard that story that you just gave, but I think, it is a profound sense of helplessness that I think has come with this frequent misrepresentation of reality. I think there's a common feeling underneath this. We all knew that, this is for people who support this president. We know that this is that kind of personality, that there's a lot of untruth that goes on. But that's just part, it's sort of the general population. It is what it is. We knew this about this person, and we can all operate within this created world. But I think that that's proving not to be true. And I think, again, it's hard for people to really internalize how much repeated falsehood information and mistrust of good information does change the nation. I mean, people's thought processes are changing, and things are normalizing when it comes to the truth. It is not true that people say all politicians lie, all politicians do this, that, or the other thing. That's a vast overstatement of the situation. It's along the same lines of a sort of rhetorical device that I think the president uses, which is to say, if I say that, they're just going to criticize me for that. They're going to criticize me for that. I can never win. And it's actually not true. There's plenty of support out there for things when they happen the right way, but you create a sense of helplessness. And I feel like we are getting in this country taught to have a kind of helplessness. But the upcoming election may shift that sense of helplessness.
And we should not normalize these kind of behaviors. And if we have time later on, we'll talk some more about the upcoming election. Every 10 years, United States federal government carries out the population census, which is currently taking place. What is the importance of the census? Why is it important for everyone in the country to be counted, regardless of immigration status?
And it's essential. It's an essential process that the government is involved in. And it's important because it contributes to the economic success of the country. And really, everyone has a vested interest in having businesses, for instance, local services that are specific and understand the nature of the community with which they're functioning. And that's one of the things that the census provides. It provides businesses with information. It provides corporations with information. It provides the government with information. So in terms of, if you're a business owner, you want people to fill up a census. If you are a local citizen, you want people to fill out the census. It's good for everyone because it helps create that particular structure. But then it also helps with 911 services. It helps with our representation in government, right? Making sure that the states have the right number of representatives in the federal government. And then I came across, I didn't really realize this until recently, but there is a sort of, it also, filling out the census becomes your sort of backup plan. If you lose an important document or if you need to verify something about your past, your census records actually can contribute to that as well. So, yeah, the census is really essential to the functioning of democracy.
So, as you mentioned, it's just briefly, in terms of the population in each district, so each state may be allotted certain number of members of the House of Representatives. I remember some time ago, the state of Connecticut had six members in the House of Representatives, but due to population decline or decrease, we lost one of our House members, and now we have five. So that also helps to say the number of members in the House in each state.
Exactly. Yeah, so and I'm not as familiar with the history of how things have changed over time, but the structure of the government is such that representatives are assigned based on the number of people in districts, and therefore the count needs to be accurate so that the representation is accurate. Exactly.
So when the guy in the White House is going around trying to disrupt this, like he does with everything, and trying to get the census to only count citizens and people who are here documented, what is he doing to the census?
Well, he's that approach, it's mystifying to me. I'm trying to understand it. And I think, if I'm not mistaken, the citizenship question is not in the census.
Indeed, it's not.
So I think the intent was more about voter control than it was about the overall counting. But I don't really know. But it came from a researcher who was using this as a way to manage voting in a way that would benefit the party, the Republican Party, I believe. And, you know, so I think the goal was about gathering information, but probably, you know, what happens when you make people afraid to fill out a census, which is what the effect of this question would be, potentially, and there seems to be a lot of evidence that people would be resistant. What you do is you get fewer people filling it out, and you don't get a full understanding of the economic needs of communities, of the social needs of communities. You misrepresent the reality. You create a space, I think, for more misrepresentation of reality. So I think it fit in a perspective that might be oriented towards lack of evidence. Evidence doesn't matter, and if you get fewer people responding to the census, you create a space for uncertainty, and in that space for uncertainty, you can throw in your ideas. You can say, well, we really don't know how many people there are because they didn't fill out the census. And there is a way in which that creates power, because you can create the story you want to tell and get rid of the hard evidence.
You're listening to What's Your Point on WPKN Radio. My guest is Kathy Cook, founding dean at the Honors College and professor in the history department at the University of South Alabama, Mobile, Alabama. I am Garnet Ankle. We're discussing various current national challenges of the day, and a little bit more on the census, Kathy, in that also the allocation of federal dollars in terms of, so when we have an accurate count of the number of people in each state, each district, we'd be able to accurately allocate federal dollars to them. Isn't that
so? Exactly. It's a crucial mechanism of funding in the country. And there are a lot of federal dollars, and if the counts are not accurate, the money is not distributed in the way in which our national structures are designed for it to be distributed. It's an undermining of the way in which the nation works.
So when this guy is doing that, even going to court to have them put this citizenship question on the census, which is not required, it is just confusing and boggles the mind.
It's not relevant to the census is about counting the people in the United States, and that is the problem. And if given the larger attack that's been going on on immigration, both legal and illegal, or not illegal, I'm sorry, I put that wrong, undocumented immigration in this country, it creates incredible insecurity for people who might say, no, I'm not a citizen.
So what is the role of the press, the media, in the United States?
Well, it's essential. The Washington Post has on its masthead, "Democracy Dies in Darkness." And I suppose one could, if one wanted to use that, is the press is the light, or one of the sources of light. I think that the free press is essential. It allows for the opportunity to uncover this other story. So leaders or the person who's speaking, whoever they are, but in the case of leaders, they tell a story. They present us with an interpretation of the political scenario or of the world or the budget issue or whatever it is, and the free press is the fact checker. It's the group that comes in and says, wait a second, I want to make sure that this is accurate, or I want to present another point of view. They are, I would argue, our thought partners as American residents and citizens. We need a thought partner, and the free press steps in and looks for the questions that need to be asked and helps to present them.
Yeah, so the free press is usually called here in this country the fourth estate. So they keep the government in check, irrespective of which government is there, Republican, Democrat, whatever. A free press is essential in any democracy. So if this guy in the White House is calling the free press the enemy of the people, only to report things about him, and they're usually true, doing their job, he's calling them the enemy of the people, would you say that he is a threat to democracy if he behaves like that?
I believe that language is a threat to democracy. We need a free press. There's just no way around it. It is a sort of rhetoric that, for me, the real concern would be if that was taken seriously. And that's something I have to assess. But it's a deeply divisive, deeply problematic thing to say. It would be, when you put it in terms of the Fourth Estate and the checks and balances system, it would be akin to saying Senate is the enemy of the people or the Supreme Court is the enemy of the people. So it's a shocking thing to say. I don't think there's any way around it. It's deeply concerning. It definitely undermines democracy. And I think it's one of the reasons that education is so crucial. The free press is a way for people who, don't have an educational institution in their lives day to day, whether you're a student or a faculty member, a staff member. This is your ongoing education in democracy. And to undermine that and to, if the free press is the enemy of the people, what is the friend that you want to replace it with? And I don't see an answer to that question. So, yeah, it's alarming, without a doubt.
So from your perch at the University of South Alabama, what would you say is the atmosphere there where race relations are concerned?
Mobile is an amazing city. I'm a fan of Mobile, and it's a minority-majority city. Mobile is also in America. And like, say, school system in New York, right, which has recently been in the press for being incredibly segregated, the school systems in Alabama are incredibly segregated. So I want, as one example, so one of the reasons I moved to South was to sort of put some legs on an idea that I had. And the idea is that it's easy if you have a box that you can put the racism in the country into. So say one wants to say there is racism in this country, but it's all in the South. It allows you to not see the racism in the North. My position is that this country, in systemic terms, has racism everywhere, and the school systems are one example of that. But it's in New York as well as the city in Alabama. So I always want to be careful to not let regional expectations blind us to the evidence, to the reality of systemic racism throughout the country. So yes, Mobile has systemic racism, and Alabama does, but so does New York City and New Haven, Connecticut. And that is absolutely not to dismiss it, but instead to say just how deeply ingrained this is in the United States of America.
And of course, you want to make sure you give an answer, so you are going to be welcome back down there when you go. I'm just kidding. I'm just joking. Yeah, but yes.
Well, I think people know this, right? It's no secret.
Yes.
And I suppose I can add on, you're absolutely right. And I can add on to it that there is awareness. You cannot live in the Deep South and not be aware of the role that race has played in the construction of the state and in its ongoing relationships. But it is the home of the Equal Justice Institute, where Bryan Stevenson is in Montgomery. Selma, Alabama, where John Lewis crossed the Edmund Pettus Bridge. I took my students there and did walk the bridge on the commemoration. So it is also a place that is grappling, and in some ways maybe more explicitly than any other place, not any other, that's way too broad, but it is grappling in an intentional way with its racial past and present. You know, for me, because I feel like our country has been so deeply, the racial foundations, the ways in which race have informed, they're formed, not informed, but formed this country, and the harm that came with that, it's just so deep and such great scarring that I'm relieved, of course, to see efforts to grapple with it. There's just so much that needs to be done. It's a place that's really trying, and I'm not sure there's ever enough, right? But I think there is effort.
So, from your observation, what would you say is the relationship between the police there and black people?
Can you say the first part, between who and the black people?
Okay. What is your observation in terms of the relationship you see between the police in the area and black people?
Yeah, I cannot tell you. I do not have a good sense of that. So I can't give you a specific answer, a very precise one. I know that college campuses have police forces everywhere. I have noticed that institutions sometimes tout their police forces as important to the university experience. And that has, as my consciousness has arisen, which needed to happen, that has struck me as strange, in that if you believe in diversity, as you know what happens with police forces, with the evidence-based disparities in how African Americans are treated, it's incontrovertible fact. It's a difficult thing to tout your police department. So I think about it in the college and university context. But again, I think I live in New Haven, Connecticut, and I think that there are episodes in any police force across the country. So, but I don't know any specifics beyond that, except that I would say as a region of the United States, it shares in the flawed relationship between the police and black. Flawed is an understatement. You know, these are real human beings with their lives on the line every day.
And the time has flown past, and it's almost time for us to take a wrap on the show for today. Any parenting shots, anything, any closing remarks before we say so long?
Oh, wow, this time has flown by. I really appreciate the time. And I think, you know, I just look for, I just want to think about the role of government in our lives. And I think about Jean-Jacques Rousseau, who said that, you know, we have a social contract that forces us to be free. And that notion that to become fully human, you need a social contract. I look forward to this country, and even now, but there's an opportunity for us to really provide for an opportunity for people to be their fullest expressions of their human selves, to really have a full and rich human experience available to everyone, for everyone to be able to maximize their potential. I believe that that's why we have the government, a social contract that gives us the chance to be the fullest expression of ourselves, and we need that to be shared in every type of human expression. And then the other thing I think is our government is supposed to be there to anticipate the worst so that we don't have to think about it as much, and that means things like Katrina. And the United States had an incredibly flawed response to Katrina, and it also means pandemics. And that, I think, those two things are what I hope for in government and what I think we have a real possibility for with competent leadership.
So maybe education could play a part where that is concerned in terms of race relations. Maybe you should teach multicultural relationships in every classroom from kindergarten up to the PhD level. But then again...
Well, absolutely. And I would even say, if you live and spend time with people who are seemingly different from you, then you are going to see them as people who should have an equal opportunity to live a full life. So absolutely multiculturalism, but I would say in most of experiences with people who are like you and not like you, that's a complicated thing to say, but I mean, We have too much homogeneity and segregation in our society, and I think that our education needs to involve people who are that implicit diversity. And also, I would say we also need to be educated to figure out how to manage our emotional reactions. And I do think that's one of the things that is happening in this country is that fear is being used to manage the population, to sort of wield the power of, lack of evidence. And that's not just fear. The pandemic has changed. It's introduced a different kind of fear, but previously it's fear of violence, fear of losing the jobs. All of these sorts of fears have been used to manage people, and I think we need as people to be educated, because there's a lot of good work on this about how to recognize how your fear or your excitement or your anger or your joy, all of these things have an impact on how we think. And that has been used, I think, in the contemporary circumstance to mismanage how people think in a way that's not rational and not good for democracy.
Okay, thank you so much, Kathy, for being here. And this is the first of many times I'll be calling on your expertise to talk about these issues. And thanks again for doing it.
Thank you,
Garnet. You're welcome. The proceeding was a conversation with my former professor, founding dean of Heroes College, and professor in the history department at the University of South Alabama, Mobile, Alabama, Kathy Cook. We discuss various current national challenges, the federal response to the COVID-19 pandemic, the elections in November, and the census, among other topics. Thank you for listening. Just a reminder, What's Your Point is aired fortnightly on this radio station, WPKN, Sunday at 9 a.m. Eastern. So catch me in a fortnight when I'll be here to do it for you all over again. You do take care. This has been What's Your Point with Garnet Anklin.